Welcome to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Ian Part from Bad Press Inc., all the way from the UK. Ian, glad you could join us.
Hi there.
So,
pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining us. We have appreciated you being here for the last hour while we waited on The Wolf to show up so we could actually do this podcast. And I'm kind of regretting the fact to invite The Wolf to this, because now I realize I'm going to be on a podcast with two British people and y'all are going to start talking about all kinds of British stuff that I'm not going to understand.
The funny thing is, you moved into the other room, but I can still literally hear you because you're talking so loudly.
Well, it's just like the typical Americans. We had to get away from you people. We had to go find somewhere else to be because y'all were just being so mean to me. So as a typical American,
well, how that works out.
I went and stuck a claim over here, and now this is my new little territory.
Well, as Ian will tell you, it was the same thing with Europe. We gave it a little bit of a test, and then they had to bugger off. So because we're not really happy with anybody after a bit.
Yeah, we're a quarrelsome lot.
Yeah. We're just like, it's funny because like over here, obviously in America, you know, you have college rivalries, all this type of stuff. But like in England, you pick a quarrel with somebody who lives the other side of the street from you. It's like you're too organized in your quarreling and arguments in America. It's like, oh my goodness, yeah, they went to this university, so they're our rivals and stuff. But yeah, you could end up and having a punch up at the bus stop, you know, in England, just because somebody came from a different side of the street.
Different postcode.
Yeah, different postcode. Oh, look at that wanker from there, from CB44UQ.
Yeah. Wrong side of the river is the problem.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, Ian, you're an author, you're a publisher, you have Bad Press Inc. Lead us through what got you into the author game.
Insanity, mainly. Yeah, so I started writing. I went and worked for about 2.5 years out in East Africa. And I started writing there as an aid to sanity, to just try and put down some of the stuff I was dealing with at the time. And then came back to the UK and forgot all about it, having written about 180,000 words of deathless prose. And then I got made redundant at one point. And I was didn't have anything to do while I was between jobs for about 2 months. And I thought, well, I wrote this huge thing. I might as well get it finished. So I finished it off and then tried to get it published by going to agents, etc., and played rejection slip bingo for about a year. And then thought, I'll go and do it myself. So I self-published it eventually. And then thought, I quite enjoy doing this. So I then started to write some other stuff, or looked around for what I was going to write next. And I was always I was always fascinated by the biker life. I'm a biker, but I was always fascinated by the sort of the 1% of lifestyle, read a lot about it and followed it in the papers. And whenever it's portrayed on the TV or in films or whatever, it always was shown as sort of almost a joke. You had sort of the Clint Eastwood films, Every Which Way. You had bikers appearing in things as sort of comedy villains. And I thought, this is a serious lifestyle. Why isn't anybody writing anything serious about it? And I thought, well, if nobody else is going to do it, I'll do it. So I started and wrote a one-off book, Heavy Duty People, which was about a guy getting involved in a 1%er club and what that meant for him and his relationships and the choices he had to make, etc. And it was just going to be a one-off thing. And so I wrote it, and again, couldn't find anybody who wanted to touch it with a barge pole, so self-published it. Thought no more about it for about a year until two of the characters met up in my head one day and had a meeting, which was chapter one of the second book, Heavy Duty Attitude. And they were just off, and I was just along for the ride, to be honest. They just took the thing and went, and all I did was followed on behind, just writing down what they did, and it went on from there. So I got to eventually, I'd ended up having written 6 books in a trilogy. And I've been stuck on book 7 for about 3 years now, because book 7, I've got a plot for it, but it will probably draw a lot of things together and it will sort of bring it to an end.
If I can give you any advice from the Star Wars franchise, don't do episode 7.
Yeah, that's probably good advice.
Absolutely.
But the trouble is, I keep getting grief on Facebook because every time I go onto Facebook, somebody sends me a note saying, "What are you doing on here? Get back to writing a book, because when's the next one coming out?" So, right. Once you're onto this, it's a bit of a treadmill, isn't it? Really.
Oh, it most certainly is. So, Ian, for those people out there that don't really follow the biker lifestyle, the biker world, you've used the term one percenter. Explain to us what a one percenter is.
A one percenter is somebody who's a member of one of the outlaw motorcycle clubs. There was famously an American Motorcycle Federation spokesman after the Hollister riots, I think, which was back in 1947, who said, well, 99% of motorcyclists are law-abiding, good, upstanding people. A number of people then decided, well, if that's the 99%, I'm going to be the 1%. And self-identify as the outlaws. So a one percenter is somebody who is a member of an outlaw motorcycles club, essentially.
I actually thought Max said placenta there, so that kind of confused me for a little bit. But I mean, you know, obviously growing up in England myself, I mean, motorbiking wasn't really a big thing. I mean, you know, most bikes in England were like street bikes. You know, I didn't know of any gangs, I didn't know of any clubs. You know, you saw somebody on a bike and, you know, that was it. You didn't really think about it that much. And I, you know, wasn't aware of any culture. And, you know, I left England when I was like 30. But, you know, I wasn't aware. I mean, it's a very underground culture as opposed to here in America, where it's a very prominent and very, I guess, in your face culture. Everybody knows, you know, there's motorbike clubs over here. But in England, I mean, you didn't really kind of know about it at all.
It was a different culture. In the UK, it's an interesting mix, I think, because you had the sort of rocker culture from the 60s, and then you had the outlaw biker culture, which is a very American phenomenon. But the American clubs, once the American clubs became famous, people started to follow the same lifestyle in the UK and elsewhere overseas, and formed independent groups or independent clubs that were similar to the American ones. And then the sort of the big brands, if you like, of the larger and more well-known outlaw motorcycle clubs have then expanded worldwide and absorbed many of the local clubs. So you have, in the UK, you have a number of the sort of the worldwide known outlaw motorcycle club brands, as it were. You still have a number of independent, locally established outlaw motorcycle clubs. And then you have the wider variety of the motorcycle culture, which is everything from, you know, your mom and pops who are riding Harleys and are members of the HOG, the Harley owners group, through to sort of loose associations of mates who just go out for a ride on a Saturday. So you do have quite a wide range of bikers and the biker community in the UK.
Now, how does the, you know, police treat it over there? Because like over here, I mean, obviously you have established clubs which have been around for decades, unless there's something going on like heavy, you know, drug dealing or something, when the FBI get involved, I mean, they're normally left to their own devices as such. I mean, I'm sure Max, you know, Shep knows way more about that than I do. But like over in England, you know, I mean, it's a very nanny state in terms of, like, you know, as soon as you kind of do one thing remotely wrong, they try and close the whole thing down. So, I mean, does it come automatically with this, like, I don't know, maybe I guess precedence of like, oh, they're bikers, so they're bad, so let's keep an eye on them, let's, you know, curtail everything they do. I mean,
earlier on this year, where about three or four people were, I think, no, actually probably more than that, about half a dozen people were convicted of basically going around and beating up a smaller club because they didn't want to merge with a larger one. It's relatively low level. It's not in your face. You know, we don't have the sort of the Waco type situations over here.
Right, yeah.
That are the big news. The last time anything like that happened that was really big news would probably have been about 30 or 40 years ago.
And that's the thing. I mean, you talk about the scale and you talk about relativity. I mean, over here, I mean, if like three or four people get shot, you know, even within like about 10 miles of us, you know, it might or might not, you know, make the news. You know, and it might be like gangs of any type, but, you know, it just doesn't make the news. Whereas, you know, obviously I remember when, you know, I lived back in England, you had anything like that, it'd be, you know, the top story for like three or four days on the news. But here it just doesn't, you know, a lot of associative crime just kind of goes unnoticed a lot of the time, but they still have bad rep overall here, you know, like biker gangs, as they think, you know, it's these people who are just going around causing trouble. And a lot of the time, I mean, just like you said, you know, it's like, just like in England, you know, a bunch of grey-haired people who just want to go for a ride with their mates, you know, at the weekend. And that's how it really is for the majority of people here as well. You know, it's just a bunch of people who, you know, they go out, buy a Harley, and especially, you know, here in the States and here in Texas, you know, you've got so much open road, so many places you can go and ride, and people just want to do it, you know, and have fun. But it's got, so this is associative, like, imagery with it, where people just think, oh, right, yeah, they're out there to cause trouble. But, you know, you've got some ex-insurance agent or real estate guy here. He just wants to go out a ride with his, you know, his mate at the weekend, you know.
And, from the police's point of view, you know, if you're in the police, you need people to police. You need targets to investigate. You need, you know, an enemy almost to be looking at. And
well, it's easy now, Ian, because you're not wearing a mask, mate. They could knock on your door any moment right now.
Yeah, well, most of the time I do wear a mask, you know. So, you know, I was saying to Max, it's really weird. You know, you now have to wear a mask to go into the post office, to go into the bank.
I've never got round the fact of like identifying people by their eyes, but now it's having to be a kind of, oh, that's who that is. You know, you can't see the bottom half of their face.
It's weird from that point of view over here at the moment.
Now it's a weird thing in terms of, you know, we have a lot more Asians over here, and for whatever reason they kind of bring that part of their culture over with them. So I mean I lived up in the Northeast for quite a while when I first came over here to the States, and so I was used to, you know, when I used to go into, like, you know, New York, like going to Manhattan like 2-3 times a week, you know, I'd see a lot of Asian people wearing masks. I mean, they were germaphobes a lot of the time, and so it wasn't super bizarre. Obviously in England, I think, you know, unless somebody was operating on you, you never saw anybody wear a mask.
Until I think the first time I noticed somebody wearing a mask was in March, and I was at a trade fair. And two people came round this trade fair wearing, this is right at the beginning of March, just before it really hit over here. Two people came round wearing masks, and we were all standing there thinking, they're overreacting a bit, aren't they?
Right. Yeah.
A month later, you know, it's mask city everywhere. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bizarre thing, but yeah, kind of, as the chef probably told you, we kind of drift off topic a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, I noticed.
you should hear some of our expert science topics. If you haven't listened to any of our podcasts on very specific science topics, you need to listen to some of them, because you will learn everything and nothing about the topic.
Well, that's typical with any of our podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
We obviously learned that having, you know, three of us on a podcast, that we still have to sit in different rooms, and then, you know, I don't know, we're going to have to listen back, because I think we might have lost some of this because I forgot to bring my hotspot into the other room. So we'll just have to figure that out when we get there.
But we also, for the first 3 weeks, had our microphones turned the wrong way around. So
that is true. little known fact, when we first started the podcast, we bought some microphones and everything, and no kidding, we had them turned around backwards for whatever it was, like the first few weeks, and we couldn't figure out why the sound was so bad. And so we finally decided, hey, let's ask Google. And sure enough, we had the microphones backwards, the little dynamic mics that hang down. Once we turned them around, all of a sudden, hey, this sounds a lot better. So,
now, is Ian still with us? Because he's not on the screen.
I'm still here.
Oh, you're still here. All right. You disappeared from the screen, because otherwise the shepherd may as well just come back here and sit opposite me if like you've gone.
I know. I'm not going to sit that close to you.
Well,
it's the smooth professionalism of it all. It just really impresses, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yes. It's like the BBC when it had some credibility. Now, Ian, I did want to ask you, I mean, how do you market your books? Do you now? I mean, obviously with social media, because, you know, again, like, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there wasn't this ability to be able to easily connect with groups of a like mindset. But now, I mean, obviously you can go on Instagram, you go on Facebook, Twitter, whatever, and you can find these groups of people. And it's like, really, there's that many people who like, you know, taking squirrels out to eat in a restaurant. But I mean, it's a much easier way to find your audience now. And it's, you know, in terms of how you market your books, I mean, what route do you go, given, I think, you know, it's, you call easier, it one center, you know?
I think it's easier to identify an audience to market to. But actually, I think it can be more difficult in some ways because there is just so much noise out there. And there's only so many times you can put out a tweet that says, buy my book, it's brilliant, before people turn off. And what you've actually got to do is you've got to engage with an audience and you've got to be talking to that audience. And, you know, I don't know about Max, but I mean, basically I started writing because I'm antisocial and just like being on my own and shutting the door and telling the world to sod off. You know, and then suddenly you've got to convert yourself into this social animal that goes out and sort of talks to people. And that's, you know, as a writer, that's really not what I do. So there is a bit of a dichotomy in what writers have to do, I think, quite often.
Right.
But you have to get out there and engage with an audience and build a relationship with them. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of doing, to be honest. Much more time than writing the bloody books.
Right. And I think, you know, it's the same issue with, you know, when you look at music, right? You used to have a representative, you had to have a record label, and now anybody can release a song on iTunes. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, it's not you being able to get a platform. The problem is that you're merged in with a whole bunch of people whose stuff might be crap. And now your issue is, how do you get people to actually realize your stuff is good? And like you said, it's not just noise. I mean, you might be the 90th person, you know, within a month to say, hey, I've written a book about, you know, motorcycle clubs or whatever. But how do you differentiate yourself in this platform now, given anybody can literally just write it down on a piece of A4 paper and be like, hey, yeah, I've published a book.
You've got to have, it's visibility. They have to be able to find you. And then once they've found you, it's credibility. So you have to have a professionally produced product, and you have to have the social proof of people leaving reviews, etc. So when I first published my book, The Heavy Duty People, yeah, you know, I did a homemade cover. Whack, whack, oops, you know, big mistake. So now if you go to buy it, it's got a professionally produced cover that's been created by a professional book designer, because you're on Amazon, you're competing against all the other books that have been written by everybody else. And you get that, if you can persuade somebody to get to or lead them to your page on Amazon, you know, they're going to see a picture of your cover, which is about yay big. They're going to see about four lines of the blurb, and they're going to see how many stars it's got in terms of reviews. And that's it. You know, that's yeah. The decision on which potentially they're going to make a decision. Is this worth me even looking at the what's inside and reading the first couple of pages or not?
Well, so I had a book
you've got to
published.
Be as professional yeah. as possible about that.
Yeah. Well, I had a book published about a hedgehog who lived in a burnt out car who went on raves at the weekend. So, I mean, I know it's not hard, you know, to kind of get a book published, but it's a weird scenario that there's now so many avenues of distribution, all these different channels of a distribution, but it's almost harder than it used to be maybe 20 or 30 years ago, because again, you're competing against these people who just put out crap. And it's the same thing like with TV. You know, you used to turn on the TV, you know, you might like a show, didn't like a show, whatever. But now there's so many channels and so much crap. It's like, you know, if you put out something quality, how do you get it noticed?
And if you think about, I had somebody call me up last week for a chat. It was son of a friend. And they were asking me, so how do I make a career writing? And I said, well, I've got three bits of advice for you. One is get writing. The second is get marketing. And the third is get lucky. But you can make your own luck by what you do in terms of promotion.
Yeah.
But if you think about people, the other question, the follow-up question was then, well, you know, how do I sell my books? How do I make sure my books sell? And I turn that on its head and say, okay, what makes you buy a book? And I think there's probably about five different things that would do that. What makes you buy a book? It's by somebody you've read before and you liked it, so you're going to buy the next one. You might even be gagging, waiting for the next one to come out. But, you know, so you've got to become an established author and build that fan base, and then it starts to work for you. You might see a review in the papers, that gives, oh, that sounds interesting, I'll have a look at that. You might see something that's that has been made into a TV show or a film, and you think, oh, I enjoyed that, I wonder what the book's like. Or you might pick it up in a bookshop because you like the cover. Oh, the blurb sounds interesting, I'll flick through the first few pages. Oh, that sounds engaging, I'll go and buy it. But you've got to get into bookshops for that to happen. And the fifth way, the fifth reason, and the one that I think is probably the most powerful, is because, you know, Max here says, oh, I've just read this book, I think you'd enjoy it, you ought to read it.
Right.
And that word of mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody you don't know talking to somebody else you don't know saying, you ought to read this book, that is the most powerful, but it's one of the most difficult things to actually get to happen.
Yeah, now organically, I mean, like, do you have, I guess, a breakdown of demographics? Because I don't guarantee you, like, people here, you know, in the States, reading the stories about British, you know, biker clubs and stuff would find it very interesting because they're a dime a dozen here, but they probably think, oh, it doesn't happen overseas, you know, you don't have, you know, biker clubs and all that. I mean, have you had, I mean, I don't know, sales wise you know, you have all that information, I mean, has it been very successful kind of more overseas than kind of domestically? But yeah,
I would yes, you get the stats because if you're publishing through a platform like Amazon, you get the stats about books and Kindle sales, etc. So you can track, you can actually track it now quite accurately, which is quite useful. And I get probably about equal sales between the US, which is obviously a much bigger market, and the UK, which is my domestic market. But yes, so I do get a reasonable number of sales in the US and Canada. And you can see if you go on to Amazon, you'll see the sort of numbers of reviews across the US and the UK are relatively similar, so I'm getting the same sort of feedback and traction. So and it's interesting, some of the feedback and reviews from the States are, oh yeah, it's interesting to see what's happening in the UK in terms of club scene, or god, I bet it's bloody cold riding a bike in the UK. so it's and I get feedback from sort of club type members in the States every so often, which is quite interesting. Yeah. I've had more feedback from people in the life in the States than I have from the UK.
And it's weird sometimes where the demographic comes from. I mean, one of our most successful podcasts has been from a lady who works at our local library, and she's almost got like twice as many views on YouTube for that episode as all the other episodes we've done. And some of our other ones have been like absolute classics, but for some reason we interviewed this woman from the local library, and yeah, she's currently like twice as many people viewing it. But I think sometimes there's that, if it's a little bit out of the ordinary, mm-hmm. you know, people kind of like, if they like what you do and it's a little bit out of the ordinary, but like, all right, yeah, this is going to be a little bit weird, but I'll listen to it. And like I said, that's why I thought that probably, you know, maybe your audience over here from, you know, Americans where biker clubs are not, you know, a big thing, or it's not out of the normal. I mean, probably everybody here knows somebody in a club, you know, it would be kind of, wow, like in England, they have like bike clubs and stuff. Cause I mean, you go on a day trip here, right? And it can take you 13 hours to go from one part of our state to the top part of the state, whereas in England, you know, you drive 6 hours, you're going to be like getting wet pretty quick. You're driving to the ocean, and so it's like, and also the roads, I mean, you know, there's not that many back roads, non-congested roads and stuff in England. I mean, what type of routes do people in England go? I mean, are there kind of like general routes they go on which are like biker routes in England?
Most areas will have the place that the bikers go on a Saturday or a Sunday for a run. So I live up in the northeast of England. So if you are a biker from Newcastle or Sunderland, the cities on the coast in the northeast, if you're going out on a Saturday or Sunday, you will
bloody Geordies and Mackems.
Yeah, exactly.
let me just finally interject, you know, because here I knew this was going to happen. The British guys are just going to go off. It took only 30 minutes before you start talking about stuff I have no idea what you're talking
yeah.
about. But yeah. Honestly, I thought it would be a shorter time frame than that. So good for
you. We'll provide subtitles.
Yeah.
Yeah, please send me like a little, you know, decipher script so I know what y'all are talking about.
Yeah.
But it's like the people from the cities on the coast, they will go, there used to be a cafe right on top of the hills on the North Pennines that people would just descend upon on a Saturday or Sunday. Where I grew up, just south of London, people would go to Box Hill, which is down towards Dorking, and then, you know, every so often there'd be a big ride from there down to Brighton on the coast. So there are places where bikers go to gather because that's where other bikers are and you can get a decent bacon butty.
Now, where do people go biking in the northeast? Because I've been there plenty. I actually dated a girl from a Walker in Newcastle. You know where that is? Right, yeah. That's a rough part of Newcastle. And she was a rough girl, to be honest. But where do people go biking up in the northeast?
As I say, they'll go up to the North Pennines, Alston. People from Middlesbrough will go across the North York Moors. And if you're up for riding further afield, there's a thing called the Northwest 500 now, which is a route that goes all the way around the north coast of Scotland, sort of basically up from Loch Ness, and just goes all of those big tour around Scotland, and it's absolutely beautiful. And there are some, you know, quite well deserted roads up that way. So
yeah, I mean, I know obviously the climate's crap, but you know, up in Scotland, I would think there might be some nice kind of places. I mean, I know the weather's horrible, but in Scotland, I would think there might be some nice kind of secluded places you can go, you know, at least a little bit of variety, you know, a little bit mountainous and stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
there's some beautiful roads up in Scotland to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard trying to explain Scotland to Americans because they kind of, like I said, they don't know the difference between Scotland and Ireland and Wales and stuff. They think it's all like jammed into one little kind of circle.
Scotland's where they wear kilts all the time. That's pretty much what Americans know 24/7, about Scotland.
24/7. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. That's how you recognize Scottish people. If they're not wearing a kilt, they're not Scottish. Yeah.
And the Irish people are drunk, right?
That's 100% fact also.
Okay. See, we studied history over here. We know.
Yeah, I mean, you got to stick with what you know, basically. But it's hard because I got a sports car when I was pretty young because I was playing soccer. You know, I played professional soccer, and they stupidly gave me a bunch of money, and so I went out and bought, you know, a really expensive sports car. But then it's like
an MG Midget.
No.
Oh.
Well, it should have been because the roads in England are so narrow, it's actually perfect for bikers because, you know, you've only got like 2 feet either side of you. But I just didn't have places to go and drive it and get up to a speed. And it's just like driving a regular car in, you know, a built up neighborhood. And so, you know, you think with bikers, you know, again, as I was saying to Ian earlier, like, you know, even in Texas, here in North Texas, I mean, you only have to go here, there, like 10 miles one direction, and you've got beautiful open roads. You just don't have that in England. But there are certain parts of, you know, the UK.
We have a thing called bends.
Yeah, yeah. It's Blame the bloody Romans for that stuff. Because they were supposed to make straight roads. Didn't always happen. But I can't imagine, like, growing up in Birmingham and joining a bike club because there's not really anywhere to go on that part of the you're gonna have to catch a train for like 2 hours to go somewhere and like go on a good ride. I don't know.
I lived in Birmingham for a while. We found places to go and ride.
So. It is more difficult though. I mean, there aren't really kind of the open roads, the straight roads, and places where you can get away with like driving at like 90 miles per hour. Like here, you can do that literally within 10 minutes. Like in England, there's not that many places you can go out and be like, all right, I'm just going to put my foot down on the gas and I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah, I mean, the UK is obviously a smaller country than the US, and there is less space and it is more built up. But there are still nice places that are remote to go to and to ride. British biker culture with the Rockers was, and still is, I suppose, quite an urban thing in some ways. You know, cafe racers racing between cafes on A roads, and British motorcycling culture is much more focused on, you know, the twisty bits, the bends, and the variety of riding rather than just blasting a long distance in a straight line. And so there's quite a lot of the biker culture over here is around sports bikes rather than cruisers, for example.
Yeah.
Because it's about, you know, having fun around the twisty bits.
Right. Yeah. Now, did you have, I know, you know, obviously growing up in England, but like not many Americans know about the whole thing, you know, about the mods and the rockers, because you keep talking about the rockers, right, the bikes. But, you know, there was a huge thing for maybe 3 decades with the mods and the scooters. And, you know, they'd go obviously on these, you know, day trips, especially in the south of England, you know, that, and that part of culture, I don't think I've ever heard over here in the States, but I mean, it used to be a big thing over there in the UK, you know, the mods.
I mean, in one of my books, I have a story which is set in two time periods. And one of those time periods is the 60s, and it's around rockers and mods and the sort of early days of club type culture taking root in the UK. And then the modern era is somebody investigating something that comes out of that. So it was really quite interesting to go and do some research into the mod rocker culture and all the issues around biting on the beaches at bank holiday weekends, etc., and do some digging into the reality of that, because I think the reality of it is actually quite different from the public perception of it. People didn't grow up in a mod town and suddenly meet somebody who'd grown up in a rocker town. You know, these were people who went to school together, and you know, some of them got into mod and some of them got into, you know,
West Side Story.
So help the American out here. What's a mod town? What's a rocker town?
Right. So mods and rockers were two youth cultures in the 60s in the UK. So rockers were essentially bikers who were interested in American music. They'd be wearing black leather jackets. They would ride motorcycles. Mods were people who were very interested in fashion, who dressed smartly. Were interested in European styles. They would wear suits, and they would ride scooters, and they would generally often wear parkas over their suits to protect the smart clothes they were wearing. And they were into sort of European culture and blues music and speed in terms of the drug. And so they were two youth cultures, one quite sort of American bikery orientated and one European smart culturally orientated. And they famously in the UK, there were a number of battles at bank holiday weekends where mods and rockers would have fights at the seaside. If you've come across the film Quadrophenia, that's the classic film about that scenario.
Soundtrack by The Who. It was, and that's the thing. I mean, Shepherd, mod came from the word modern, right? Yeah. And that's what insane. Yeah, they were very kind of cosmopolitan and stuff, but you know, like bands like The Who and The Jam and stuff, I mean, really, well, I mean, earlier than that, but I mean, you go to the Small Faces, everybody else, I mean, there was actually a music scene which these different bike groups would actually adopt, you know, and they would follow it. And I mean, it was a weird thing, and I know you know this, Ian, but like with the mods and on their scooters, for whatever reason, somebody come up with like, how many wing mirrors can I put on my bike? And you would have these like mod scooters, and it would have like 14 mirrors on it. And it's like, where did this come from? Because the biker thing you could understand, because they were copying another culture. But the mod thing came up, and it was like, you know, I know it came from, I guess, copying the stuff from, you know, like mainly Venice in Italy and some of the Parisians in France. And that's where the whole scooter culture came from. But all of a sudden it's like, yeah, like, oh, I'm just going to have 14 mirrors on my bike. You see how that goes, you know, it's like, you know, because nobody likes driving into the sun because you can't see. But when you have 14 mirrors, it's like, it's no worse even driving away from the sun.
If you have the same sort of, I can see the same ethos in the dresser type culture, because there are, you know, there are subsets of the biker culture which are all about decoration and dressing the bikes, etc. So it's just one of these things that's became a sort of fetish and then sort of, you know, grew.
For some strange reason the other day I thought of this. Do you how old are you, Ian? It's just the internet, mate.
Go on. 56.
56. All right. Well, I'm younger than that. But do you remember that David Essex movie, Silver Dream Machine?
Oh, God.
I've a dream, silver dream machine. That was the first single I bought, that Silver Dream Machine thing. And that was actually the first movie about, and that was about, you know, he was, you know, a biker and going on these races and stuff. But that was actually the first time, you know, I was aware of, like, oh my goodness, so people actually buy these and actually go on races. There's actually a, you know, thing, because here we don't really have bike races in England. I mean, it's a bigger thing than it is here. I mean, which is surprising, but we don't have, you know, the kind of F1 equivalent of bike races, you know, whereas in England, you would have that, you know, what was it, like Barry Sheen, was he the big,
big boy,
wasn't he, with a bike racing?
Yeah, so in UK, you have a cafe racer culture, and it has a natural interest in bike racing. So yeah, there is a big bike racing scene. And then culturally, we have the TT over in the Isle of Man.
Right.
So, you know, a week, 2 week long festival of road motorcycling, road racing on roads, and people doing extraordinary speeds around ordinary roads, you know, right, past brick walls and...
Yeah,
and absolutely some terrifying.
Hairpin bends on that stuff. Yeah, I've watched those TT races on the Isle of Man. It's like, oh my goodness, it's like, you better have some belief in God, because yeah, the speeds they get up to going around those things. Now, yeah. Shepherd, are you still online, mate?
Yeah, I'm all still right here, just
still sitting there in the toilet.
Yeah. Now, sitting here in the back room.
Was there ever kind of any racing culture that you grew up with when you started, you know, riding bikes and stuff? Was there a racing culture?
No, not really. I mean, you do have some of the, you know, what we call the slant bikes or the crotch rockets, basically.
Yeah.
You know, they like to go out and they like to pop wheelies on the interstate and do all that. And there is a little bit of motorcycle racing culture, but not like it is overseas. It's more, you know, the Asian bikes, you know, the Suzukis, the Hondas, the Yamaha.
Yeah, well, that was the same in England. It was the Yamaha. I mean, I think, Ian, is that still over there now, like Yamaha and Suzuki, like the main?
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese have come to dominate, you know, the production of bikes. So they dominate the racing scene as well. I mean, with some exceptions. So I think, yeah, BMW has been quite successful at times. You've got Triumph having a go. Every so often, somebody brings out a new Norton and has a go with that. But yes, the Japanese, they've just got the muscle these days. So.
Yeah, well, it's the cost as well. I mean, like, you look at the BMW, I mean, basic street bike compared to like buying a entry level Yamaha, and it's like a third of the cost. I mean, and that was always the case. I mean, you know, if you had a teenager wanting to buy a bike, you know, go out and buy a, you know, Yamaha. You know, here it's, you know, you have like Harley Davidson, and it's like, yeah, if you, you know, buy a Harley, you know, you're kind of, you know, you got this kind of prestige. In England, you didn't really have that. You didn't really have a bike label that people knew that, like, oh yeah, I've got a bike, and people would ask, oh, what type of bike is it? And it'd be, you know, a classic type bike. I mean, because again, most people just had the crotch rockets, they had the Yamaha, they had all this stuff. But
when I was growing up, you had the you had the sort of Brit shit versus Jap crap. You had the it was towards the end. To be honest, it was towards the end of that, because you didn't meet many people who had British bikes, because they were all sort of the manufacturers were basically on their last legs, and the structure of how you could get a bike. So you could only get a moped at a certain age, and then once you got to 17, you could get a 250, and then once you passed your test on that, then you could get something bigger. The problem being that the only people making the 250s and the mopeds, etc., were the Japanese. So everybody effectively was starting out on Japanese and then kept going on Japanese, because you couldn't, you know, you weren't going to get a 250 Harley Davidson. They just didn't exist.
Now, I don't know if the Shepherd knows what a moped is.
I do know what a moped is.
No, it's like, I think the very definition of a moped should be, if you can actually cycle faster on a mountain bike, manually than, you know, a moped. I mean, mopeds in England, like when you got them, I think they had a top speed like between 18 and 22 miles per hour, which is why anybody could buy them. I mean, you could literally pedal a bike faster than a freaking moped, and that's why the licenses are real easy.
When they did get up to being able to do a speed of about 50 miles an hour.
Yeah, they fell off a cliff. Yeah.
And then they brought in a restriction. And they were limited, so they would only do 30 miles an hour. And so when I was 16, I got a moped and it would do 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So I decided the really bright thing to do would be I go long distance touring on it. So I packed all my stuff onto the back of it and I went from London down to Cornwall on this thing on a tour.
Took 9 days.
Just about. I mean, it's like 300, you know, yeah. 250, 300 miles each way on a moped does 30 on the flat and less if it's going uphill. Looking back, it was slightly painful.
Yeah. Well, that was always the thing about how do you get the top speed out of a moped? It's like push it over a cliff. I mean, if it reached terminal velocity, that was a top speed. But yeah, I mean, the good thing about it was, I mean, you know, when we had people over there, you know, still buying it when they're in school, you know, they're like, oh, they've got a moped and they're driving it around. But then, you know, I'd be pedaling on my bike and I'd be like overtaking them.
Well, moving on from bikes, Ian, you know, we could probably sit here and talk about bikes for hours. I
mean, we could.
Obviously, Tristan, who doesn't have a motorcycle right now, is much more enthralled with it than I am, asking all the questions. But, that's fine. But
you still look like Max Headroom, by the way.
Yeah, I know I do. Well, you forced me into the back room here. You were being lazy.
Typical logo looks good, though, don't it? Look at that. Ian, do you like that logo? It looks fantastic. We paid somebody $5 to make that logo. So £2.50 to make that little logo, and they did it for us.
I can see where the money's gone in this production.
Yeah, you can be, and it's like
we put 90% of our budget on the logo.
Yeah, and as long as you don't zoom into it too much, it still looks really good. So. Yeah. But once you start zooming into it, even those circles like get a little bit fuzzy. But,
yeah, just a little bit. So, Bad Press Inc. Other than your bike or your books, Ian, what all's going on with Bad Press Inc.? What you got going?
Okay, so Bad Press. So I'd set up my own publishing house to publish my stuff, which was I call bad-press.co.uk, and I had, in order to just publicize stuff, I'd put some stickers on the back of my car with the logo, and my wife and I were sat at a roundabout waiting to pull onto a roundabout one day to go into stores to go shopping, and there was this bang on the window, and there was this guy who was black, long hair, tattoos everywhere, banging on the window, and my wife ran the window down and he said, "Are you a publisher?" And we said, "Well, yeah, sort of," and we proceeded to have this conversation out the window with this chap, who then we ran into in the car park when we were going into the shops, and he is an ex punk goth glam punk rock singer who ran a band called Spit Like This, and was very successful in sort of that field, and had written his autobiography, which seemed to be doing quite well and got onto the bestseller lists in Amazon, and his girlfriend who was in the band, and we just started chatting about publishing, and having been involved in producing books for quite some time, you know, I knew a fair bit about how the publishing industry worked and, you know, how you got stuff produced to be so it could be sold through shops, etc. And my wife, Pat, is a professional copy editor and proofreader, which is always handy to have in the background, frankly. But neither of us felt that we were particularly good at the marketing side of it. I mean, I've made a go of marketing my own stuff, but not so I was go out and sort of sell myself as a marketing guru. Whereas this guy and his girlfriend have come from being quite successful in marketing themselves and developing a following as a rock group. They also both run internet-based companies that sell, so internet trading companies, so marketing, etc. And eventually, over various chats, we decided, well, actually, yes, why don't we pull together a publishing company to publish stuff that we would like to read that nobody else seems to be publishing? So we set up badpress.inc and then started to look for people who had weird and wonderful things that we could publish. So we're up to five published authors so far. We've got another three that are coming out over the first part of 2021. And we've got a follow-up to one of our author's books, so a second in a series that's going to come out towards the back end of 2021. And we're just having a ball. It's quite it's great fun.
Is it still hard over there to do stuff like that? Because like here, you go online, you spend like $9.99, you've got a publishing house, you've got this and that. Is it still really difficult over there to kind of do things, or is it now easy to set up? It is
easy to set up, but I come back to what we were talking about before. If you're going to do it, you have to treat it as a business and you have to produce a good product. So, when we sign somebody up, I am committing us to spending several thousands of pounds producing a decent book and marketing and promoting that book. We have a retained PR professional that we pay who is out there networking to bloggers, etc., to try and get reviews for books. At the moment, it's just a huge money pit, to be honest. In which we just pour ever increasing amounts of money. But it's great fun. And what you're doing is you're building a portfolio of books and a portfolio of authors. And it's a bit like being a venture capitalist in some ways, or being a record producer. You're looking for artists who have got something that is good that you think will have a market. And you're looking for artists who you think, if I support them, they can go out and sell their product, etc.
But again, it goes back to what you were saying earlier about, that kind of lucky thing. Mm. When somebody gets noticed, I mean, you never know, who the lucky client is going to be and how they hit that niche.
So of the first four we published, so the first one was a sort of comic horror thing, which I thought was quite commercial. I thought it was potentially something that would hit sort of Stephen King and Terry Pratchett type fans. So we put out that, and it's called The Axe and Grindstone. And it's sold all right, but it's not setting the world on fire. The second thing we put out was a book called Clear, which is, in some ways, it's quite a literary thing. It's a sort of almost a prose poem about the seedy underbelly of London. And I think it is absolutely brilliant. And about half a dozen people around the world have bought a copy. I think it's a great book, but just getting it to market and getting people to engage with it is very difficult. And then the third one we put out is called While Nobody Is Watching. And it's a book by an Irish woman who was in the Irish Army and served in peacekeeping forces in Lebanon. And she's come back to the UK, come back to Ireland. And she's written a book based in Cork, where she lives. And it's about somebody who comes back from the wars with PTSD. And it's a great little psychological thriller. And that's really doing very well. So that's been picked up by an American publisher. So it's going to come out in the States by an American publisher in April. We've got a follow-up using the same character. So we're starting to potentially build a series. She's networking like a good'un, I'm waiting to find that the Irish Army has ordered one for every soldier in it. Because that's the way that's sort of what she's trying to get to happen. She's in with the Irish Army's PR department, who are talking to her about, she goes on things to talk about, I was an ex-soldier and here's what I'm doing. We're in negotiations. There's a couple of TV producers who've picked it up. We have an initial what's called a shopping agreement signed, which allows them to go out and see if they can find the funding to do full TV development on it. So that one, as a little project, potentially is a gem. But you have to treat them as a portfolio,
right?
And realize that you're looking for the hits the hit or the hits that are really going to pay.
Yeah.
But you have to put money into a number of things that, you know, may not work. And you have to work with the authors as to how they are going to get their marketing going. You talked about marketing earlier on. It's what you keep coming back to with publishing. So we've got a thing called meandthemonkey.co.uk, which is a story about a monkey who is essentially the spirit of chaos, and is into smoking cigars, drinking Jack Daniels, and as much heavy firepower as they can get his hands on. And we're publishing that as a daily, essentially a daily blog. And
yeah, it sounds like the book I wrote, to be honest. Yeah.
So it comes so every day on Facebook and every day on Twitter, you'll see a bit about me and the monkey.
Yeah.
And then people can subscribe to get a weekly update. And then in due course, there will be a book produced, which is essentially the whole story that's being told through this blog. And we have then a follow-up that's being done from that, etc. So
now, hang on, not to spoil anything,
but me and the monkey kind of looks like the wolf. You never met him until today, but that's right. Actually kind of creepy. If you look it up, me and the monkey kind of looks like the wolf. I got
outside of the wanking, I don't think we have anything in common. But one of the things I was going to actually ask you, and like, I mean, I know we did, you know, obviously touch upon marketing and stuff, and you know, the oversaturation in terms of anybody can push anything out there. Have you tried, like, I don't know, because we interviewed like a guy we really didn't know. I mean, it was a guy who got a couple of Amazon shows and stuff, a guy named Jay Davis, really funny, fantastic dude. And, you know, he started doing like cartoons and stuff. He had this animation just to kind of hit all these different avenues. So when you're kind of, you know, putting something out there, which like, you know you're going to come up against all this dross, but sometimes getting your head upon the dross is like hard, because it's hard to kind of get something quality out there. So I mean, have you looked at, I don't know, maybe like other ways to just try and get things out there? I mean, because like I said, there's so many different mediums. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you really want to push something, I mean, it's both easy and hard, because you look at some of the stuff which is successful and you're like, I would not pay 1 cent for this. But then you look at some of the stuff which is not successful and it's like brilliant, but like it's almost an accidental discovery sometimes when you find some brilliant stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we spend money on making sure we've got a good product. So the monkey, for example, so we have a professional cartoonist who is doing the illustrations to that, and there's a new illustration every week illustrating, you know, a theme, an event that's happening in it. In terms of getting it out into the marketplace and spreading the message, I've dabbled in the past with video, I've dabbled in the past with, you know, just blasting stuff out, I've dabbled in the past with doing paid for advertising. You can spend a lot of money doing stuff and not getting much of a return. Yeah. And I think you also have to do the stuff that works for you. It has to be something you enjoy and that you will be able to commit to and carry on doing because you enjoy doing it. Because otherwise, you'll do it for a bit and then it'll just fade away.
Yeah.
So we look to work with our authors and say, okay, so what is going to work for you as an author? So Michelle, for example, she is, much to her surprise, she is very good at networking. So fantastic. Network like Billy O. Go and see all your local bookshops. You know, talk to the Irish Army's PR department. See if you can get onto into the Irish Army's internal magazine, etc. Andy, who writes the Monkey Book, he is a designer by trade. He does sort of animation type stuff in his ordinary work. So he's experimenting and doing stuff on Instagram and Pinterest and YouTube to create content to try and market it. And then obviously we've got, as I say, we've got our professional PR guy who is out talking to the bloggers, is talking to the press, but you know, it's very difficult to get into the mainstream press, but it really works if you can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, on my books, I managed to get one mention for about a paragraph in The Guardian one year. And off the back of that, I got sales. My sales went up by about 400-500% for 2 months. And off the back of that, I then got three inquiries about the film rights.
Right.
One from a director and two from two production companies, and eventually ended up getting optioned off one mention in a national newspaper. And I've never managed to get mentioned in a national newspaper since.
Now, have you looked at that in terms of like getting like an adaptation as such, or just like getting somebody to do like either a TV or, because again, it's like we go back to obviously when you and I grow up and we only had like three TV channels, and then Channel 4 came in, which wasn't much better. But now there's so many TV channels. Do you think that like maybe getting an adaptation of your work, if you could find somebody to do it and put it into a
that
kind of format would be?
It would be great. And I'm in year six of development hell, or is it year seven? Year seven, I think, of development hell with the biker books, because they got option for TV. So they got option for TV by a production company. The development funding was funded by one of the big channels. So they went through a 3-year process to develop a pilot episode script, a series outline, etc. You got to the end of that process and the channel that had put up the money for it said, nah, we'll pass. So then there's been a sort of 3-year period where the screenwriter who had been hired to do this has then been out trying to sell the project into other TV companies.
Right.
I mean, you've got to remember, I think that the network put up somewhere around 50 grand or so to do the development piece that they didn't then just walked away from. It was being developed as an 8-part, 1-hour TV series. And the rule of thumb I was told at the time was for every hour of TV time you see, the budget is about £1 million.
Right.
So what was being asked was for somebody to write a check for £8 million to make this series and commit to that level of expenditure, which is why I'm not completely surprised that a lot of things fall away, because, you know, you've got to be pretty sure it's going to work before you write your check for £8 million.
So if you go into this final trilogy, what are you going to do differently? I mean, knowing from your first bunch of books, what are you going to do differently going into these last three books if you write this final trilogy?
I've now written six books in this series. So the first three are a sort of self-contained set they turned into. The next three are books that are set in the world or have some of the characters, but they're each standalone type stories. And the last one that I've got a plot for effectively picks all of those up and brings them all together and meshes them all together. So you have something that answers some of the questions that have been hanging around since the first one.
Right.
And the problem I've got really is that, as I say, I've tried writing it about three different times and I've got stuck each time for different reasons. And I'm starting to wonder whether I don't really want to write the seventh one because I don't want it to be over.
Especially the topic you're writing about, there's not really an end game, is there? There is an evolution. I mean, when you talk about biking, I mean, there's an evolution. I mean, there's, you know, biker clubs and keep going, blah, blah, blah. There's not really an end game to anything. So when you, whether you invent specific characters or whatever, you have to have just something where you're going to kind of like come to a culmination of like, well, this is what life is like in this environment. And
it was the reason for writing the first one was I was interested in the subject and I felt nobody was writing anything that took it seriously, so I thought I wanted to write something that explored, you know, why somebody might get involved in that sort of environment, what it might mean for them. And then the second one was very character-led because you had a couple of characters who came out of the first one and interacted and they went and did things. And then the characters that had come into the second one carried it along to a natural conclusion. So you were following individuals, as it were, or I felt I was following individuals when writing it. And then when I came to do the first one that was sort of out of series, I was interested, each one of the other ones, I've been interested in something specific. And sometimes it's about, you know, why, how do you know who to trust? Or why do you believe something? Or why will you believe one authority and not another authority? And the characters that I've, the characters sort of help me ride through that and lead the story through it. But once a story started, the characters are off and running, and none of the other books have ended up where I thought they were going to end up, because yeah. The characters have started to do it, and the characters' own logic and how they interact with other people have just taken them in places that I wasn't expecting. So it's a bit difficult for me to do too much planning about what I'm going to write, because I don't know what they're going to do, which is sounds a bit weird, I know, but that's the reality of it.
Now, I mean, you know, avoiding the whole Fast and the Furious type timeline, it's hard to go somewhere without over-explaining. I can't remember the name of the word now, but, you know, you can explain the lifestyle of, say, like a biker. You get to a point, it's like, this is for you, or if it's not, because like over here, like I said earlier, right, people get to a certain age, it's like, I'm going to buy a bike, I'm going to go on the open road, and it's not necessarily even a lifestyle. It's just a kind of park side hobby, whereas, you know, in England, it is something a little bit more, because it's harder to get into, it's harder to, you know, affiliate with like people who, you know, into their lifestyle and stuff, and it's harder to get.
I think the one percent of lifestyle is, I mean, as I say, it's a very serious lifestyle. It's not something you pick up and drop by accident.
Exactly. You know? Here it's casual.
Real commitment.
No, yeah. I 100% get that. And that's why I think it's, I think your story there is far more interesting than it would be here. Because here it's not a 1%, and here people can just like do it on a weekend, and it's like, buy a bike. You know what I mean, Max? There are a lot of people who like are not bikers, but they go buy bikes, right?
Sure.
And they're not bikers.
Yeah, we have what we call the weekend warrior over here. And
yeah.
I mean, to be quite honest, I mean, that's what I was. I was in a club, but it wasn't a 1% club by any means. I enjoyed riding my Harley, still enjoy riding my Harley now, but I wasn't wanting to get into that mixed up world, because, you know, I had a wife and a family and everything else. I just wanted to ride my bike and have a good time, drink some beers with some people, you know, play some shuffleboard, play some pool, and have a good time. And that was it. I didn't want to devote my life to that whole world. But there are people that still, even in this, you know, even in the U.S. and it, when what was the Tuttle family, you know, the American Biker or whatever show that was, when choppers were real big, and all of a sudden there was a waiting list for Harleys and everything, you know, that time has faded in the U.S. Bikes are kind of going by the wayside. I mean, you still see them, but Harley Davidson, they're suffering. Not as many people are buying bikes. You see fewer and fewer on the road, and you know, there's too many other things like boats or whatever else that somebody wants to go do, that the bike thing is pretty much dead now.
It's still a Wild Hogs type thing.
It really is.
Like that Wild Hogs movie, you know?
Yeah. And that was kind of my outlook on it too. I liked the biker part of it, but it was never just enormous for me. I like doing it. I like my bike. I love riding my bike, but the camaraderie is good, but that whole aspect has faded off in the United States over, say, the last 10, 15 years. It's just not as big as it used to be.
Yeah, it's the same over here. It's an aging hobby for people. I mean, I think coming back to your point about the seriousness, or the point about the seriousness of the club lifestyle, I think it's interesting that there seems to be quite a large contingent who are ex-military, who have come out of the forces and are looking for the same sort of very strong camaraderie that they experienced in the forces as a substitute
sure.
family. And I think there's
a lot of that happened with the initial clubs. It, those guys came back from war. They were looking for that excitement. They were looking for something that would get them away from the just drab part of everyday life. And hopping on a bike, going 80 miles an hour with somebody 2 foot away from you, next to you, and another bike 2 foot away from you, behind you, and screaming down the highway, that was exciting. And it's hard to do now because you got states over here in the U.S. that say, oh, well, you can go ride a bike, but you got to wear a helmet and you got to do this. And I think California is one of the only states where you can lane split, even though I do lane split in Texas, but don't arrest me. But, the excitement of motorcycles is just about gone. And there's so many people that look at you when you ride a motorcycle and you say, why are you doing this unsafe thing? You know, why aren't you in a cage? Cage being a car for the non-biker type. But, I know a guy, no kidding. He rides a motorcycle. I see him once a week on Thursday mornings. And he gets on me because I don't wear a helmet while I ride my motorcycle.
Thank you. So you don't mess your hair up. But actually, yeah, one thing in.
I do have beautiful hair.
Yeah, I don't have any hair. One thing I actually wanted to ask you in is over here, bikers are absolutely renowned with patriotism, right? They're like, a lot of ex-veterans, you know, a lot of like very patriotic people. In England, I mean, what tends to make up the majority of biker groups? I mean, are they kind of patriots, very anti kind of EU? Are they, you know, very crusader oriented? I mean, what is their kind of makeup politically?
I think if it's a wide church, you've got, you know, a lot of the older guys who are riding a sort of Japanese machine or a BMW on a Saturday or a Sunday, you know, they're a real cross section of older blokes, basically.
Yeah.
If you see somebody riding a Harley or you see somebody who is, you know, looks the sort of American biker type, that sort of imagery. A lot of those are, and a lot of those, not just the outlaw bike clubs, but a lot of the sort of more organized bike clubs that are shading towards that. There's a large amount of ex-forces people in there. They will tend to be on the sort of the patriotic, nationalistic side. I mean, a lot of the people in my, obviously I'm connected to a lot of people who are fans of the books. I would say a large proportion of those are ex-forces. A large proportion of those would probably be quite happy about Brexit, et cetera.
Yeah.
You see the imagery that's being, you know, I get things in my post about veterans and support for PTSD, et cetera. There's quite a strong military ex-services vibe amongst the community, and they would have the politics you'd expect from that, really.
All right. Well, before we go, because I just have to explain this to Shepard, why is your name spelled I-A-I-N instead of just I-N? Because one of my favourite stories that I tell people over here is what was his name? I can't remember his freaking name now. But some guy, Jules Holland, he had a guest on and he was talking about his pets. And Jules said, I once had a guy who had a cat named Ian. It's like, it calls a cat Ian. But yeah, I don't. I haven't seen that very often, mate.
It's a name. don't give me too much grief for that. It's a Scottish spelling variant of Ian.
I did actually know that. I just
want
to give you a hard time about it, to be honest.
And Wolf, what part of England are you from again?
Cambridge.
Okay, so Ian, before we go, I need you to make fun of somebody from Cambridge.
He can't because it's posh and nice.
Ben Pulley, you mean?
I doubt that.
But he comes from South London, though, don't you? South London. Yeah.
No, he comes from the Fens. If you notice, when he takes his shoes off, he'll have webbed feet.
Yeah, I do have two toes, which like abnormally connected.
Yeah, it's a natural adaptation for living in the marsh.
So. But I can swim good. with that one foot, because it's all on one foot, so I basically just swim around in circles.
Yeah, give me six.
Well, Ian, we certainly appreciate you tuning in and joining us on this, and give us just a quick set of links, how to find you on social media, how to find your publishing company, all that. Give us a nice little plug before we end here.
Well, the publishing company, it's badpress.inc.
Oh, that's the one telling you.
Excuse me, matron.
That is. I'm away from home, it was actually her. So badpress.inc is the publishing company. My books, my old publishing email address is...
See, when she listens back to this,
Roomba.
You're gonna say, hey, I was trying to finish up and you kept bothering me.
It's just Roomba, so it's banging against the chair.
So bad-press.co.uk is where you find me, and all my links and stuff are there, and yeah, check out the books. I'm gonna have to get that, I'm afraid.
Absolutely.
Otherwise I'm in too much trouble. Okay.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. We appreciate your support. And when you get a chance, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts.